It's 6 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
U.S. Ambassador to UN says staggering need in Ebola response. U.S. and British forces close base in southern Afghanistan. I'm Ray Kugel reporting from Washington. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations is calling attention to the need for a greater response to the Ebola outbreak that's killed almost 5,000 people in West Africa. Samantha Power posted on Twitter early today after spending a day in Guinea that the scale of need is staggering and that the most basic resources will help save lives. Ambassador Power says she hopes to gain a better understanding of which resources are needed to fight the spread of the virus.
I want to say to the Guinean people on behalf of President Obama that we stand with you and we will be with you till the end, until we have ended this horrible epidemic in your country.
Ambassador Power will also visit Sierra Leone and Liberia, the other two hardest hit countries. Tunisia held its first full-term parliamentary election since the country's dictator was overthrown in the revolution of 2011 that kicked off the Arab Spring. Candidates from 90 political parties competed Sunday for 217 seats in parliament. The members of the parliament will then elect a new prime minister. Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko says exit polls from Sunday's parliamentary election show strong support for his push for democratic reforms and closer ties to the European Union. The president's comments came after two polls showed the Petro Poroshenko bloc and other pro-Europe parties had dominated the elections. Exit polls show Mr. Poroshenko's bloc with 20% of the vote, but short of an outright majority. This is VOA News. Brazil's President Dilma Rousseff was re-elected to a second term. With 98% of the vote counted, Ms. Rousseff won 51.5% over her opponent, center-right Senator Écio Neves. Syrian activists say more than 800 people have been killed in ground fighting in Kobani in a six-week battle between Islamic State militants and Kurdish fighters for control of the Syrian town just south of the Turkish border. The British-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says that about 500 jihadists and more than 300 Kurds have been killed. American fighter jets launched five more airstrikes on Islamic State positions in the last day, with plumes of black smoke from the blast billowing into the skies over Kobani on Sunday. British and U.S. soldiers have formally marked the end of combat operations in Afghanistan's southern Helmand province by handing control of the country's largest military base to Afghan forces. The British flag was lowered Sunday in a ceremony at Camp Bastion, while the American flag came down for a final time at the adjacent Camp Leatherneck. At its peak, the coalition's combined base held up to 40,000 personnel, including foreign troops and contractors. As the occupation of Hong Kong by Umbrella Movement protesters nears the end of its first month, student leaders unexpectedly canceled an electronic poll on the future of the pro-democracy movement Sunday. They cited differences in objective and a lack of preparation. Ivan Broadhead has more.
The Hong Kong Federation of Students, Scholarism and Occupy Central issued a joint statement with pan-democracy legislators and civic groups Sunday, explaining why the vote was cancelled. "We admit we did not have enough discussion with the people before deciding to go ahead with the vote. We apologise to the people," read a prepared statement from the three organising groups. The electronic referendum, due to be held Sunday and Monday, was expected to propose two motions on the direction of the Umbrella Movement. In particular, its leaders were seeking a clear mandate to call for constitutional reform in time for the election of the next Hong Kong chief executive in 2017. Ivan Broadhead for VOA News, Hong Kong.
The European Central Bank says that most of the banks in the 18-nation euro currency bloc could survive a financial crisis, an assessment that could help spur more lending to boost the eurozone's flagging economy. The central bank says that at the end of last year, 25 of the 130 biggest banks failed a financial stress test and needed to raise $32 billion in order to have enough capital on hand to cover losses during any severe economic downturn. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Batty in Washington. Today is Monday, October 27th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. ICC Chief Prosecutor defends the courts in Africa involvement.
We are not in Africa by design, or because that's what we desire to do, or that it's because we are going there to target Africans. We are in Africa because African states, African governments are requesting the intervention of the ICC.
Fatou Bensouda is the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. Burkina Faso is tense as protesters gear up ahead of this week's vote to amend the constitution for President Blaise Compaoré. And Ghana's public sector workers say they will continue their strike over pensions.
The strike or partial withdrawal of services is going to continue until such a time where government is able to get us to the negotiating table and agree on the issues that are on the table.
Justice Yanksen is General Secretary of the Ghana Medical Association. The President of the University of Liberia comments on mass failures of the university entrance exam. Polls are closed in Sunday's parliamentary election in Tunisia, and U.S. health officials criticized Ebola quarantine protocols in two major cities. Those stories, plus Mark Oldman's sports and our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. A few years before the separation of South Sudan and Sudan, Darfur in Western Sudan was the topic of discussion on almost every platform in Washington, including on Capitol Hill. Some Darfuris who escaped the atrocities that led the International Criminal Court's indictment of President Bashir for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide say while the atrocities continue, attention to the continued killings and displacements of their loved ones has been directed elsewhere. To bring the focus back on the situation, the Darfur Women Action Group co-sponsor a two-day symposium titled Women and Genocide in the 21st Century. Among the future speakers were Chief Prosecutor of the ICC, Fatou Bensouda, who tells viewers Undimiyaki Mwakalele that efforts to bring Mr. Bashir to justice and end the violence in Darfur is in part due to lack of political will.
One of the dangers that we face about what is happening in Darfur is that people are forgetting. They should not forget that the crimes are ongoing in Darfur. That is why, as prosecutor of the ICC, and having investigated the crimes that are committed in Darfur, and having issued indictments against President Bashir and three others, as well as the summonses to appear that we have issued, I should also remain focused on this issue.
This indictment was issued so many years ago, and people don't seem to understand at this point why has Mr. Bashir not been arrested?
Of course, before a case can start at the ICC, there must be an arrest, or there must be the presence of the person who's indicted before the judges, before the chambers of the ICC. We've investigated, we have requested for arrest warrant to issue, and it is now the responsibility of states, especially states parties, but even in this situation of Darfur, because it is a UN referral to the ICC, it is the responsibility of every state who is part of the UN to respect that obligation of cooperating with the court and ensuring that President Bashir is arrested and brought to the ICC to face justice. But unfortunately, there is the lack of this political will to do so. However, I think that someday this will change. And I believe that one day President Bashir will find himself before the ICC.
Tell me what your experience has been like so far. Of course, in light of the indictments recently of the vice president and the president of Kenya, which have really created a backlash against the ICC.
I think firstly, I just want to say that, of course, as an African, I'm a very proud one, one that is proud of my continent, and one that is proud to serve my continent. Because I think that in all these cases that are coming from Africa to the ICC, and I having the privilege to work for those victims who are African victims, I feel honored that I am in this position to be able to do that. My job, my responsibility, my mandate is to investigate and prosecute war crimes, crimes against humanity, genocide, fairly and transparently, and in accordance with the statute, the Rome Statute and the rules.
How do you reconcile this backlash by the African leaders that you are doing what Luis Moreno Ocampo did, that he targeted and he went out of his way?
First of all, I think it is good to clarify why ICC is in Africa, and to underline that we are not in Africa by design, or because that's what we desire to do, or that it's because we are going there to target Africans. We are in Africa because African states, African governments are requesting the intervention of the ICC to investigate and prosecute.
Fatou Bensouda is the chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Court. She spoke with VOA reporter Undimiaki Mwakalele while in Washington, D.C. The General Secretary of the Ghana Medical Association, the GMA, says public sector workers will continue their indefinite strike action this week to pressure President John Dramani Mahama's government to address their concerns about pension. The government says the ongoing strike is illegal and has launched a legal challenge in court. But the GMA Secretary General, Dr. Justice Yangsen, tells reporter Peter Clotty that the administration is to blame for the strike.
The strike or partial withdrawal of services, as we will want to put it, is going to continue until such a point where government is able to get us to the negotiating table and agree on the issues that are on the table. So from onwards, it is going to continue as we speak. It's still in force. It's going to continue until we come to such a point where we've been able to resolve the issue.
Government officials have come out to say you should trust them with your pension. And why are you doubting the government about this issue?
See, the issues are simple. If you look at all the laws governing this new pension scheme we have, the new pension act states clearly that the second-tier pensions are to be managed privately, and there are rules governing how they should be managed. So that is where the bone of contention is. And then beyond that, people are going to retire just this January. That is roughly 2 months away from now. These people have no idea where to go for their pensions, who to go to, or how much has even accrued to them. And that is one big worry. We think we're not going to allow government to take us for granted on that particular point. Because here we are, people have worked for 30 to 40 years in the public service. They go on retirement and they have to go and get their lump sum via the tier 2 pension arrangement. And that we think is unacceptable. So for us, we are in a situation where we think that government ought to account properly and also let our things run. And that is our basic demand.
Dr. Yangsen, government has said that this ongoing strike is illegal and they have gone to court about this. So why embark on illegality?
Let's put it this way. As far as we are concerned, we have not embarked on any illegal strike. And for us, the determination of what is legal or illegal does not lie within the province of the government or, say, we the workers. It is only the courts of this land, competent courts, that can decide that a strike is legal or illegal. So for us, we think we've embarked on a very legal one. If they think it's an illegal one and they've gone to court, we will meet them in court. But the issues are this. Government itself was the first to perpetuate illegality by not releasing funds that were supposed to have been released 90 days after the formation of our scheme. It's been 2.5 years since this came to a form, and government thinks that they haven't perpetrated any illegality. He who comes to FEP must come with clean hands.
Dr. Justice Yangsen is the General Secretary of the Ghana Medical Association. He spoke with reporter Peter Clotty from the capital, Accra. Authorities in Burkina Faso say the country's schools and universities will be closed for the entire week beginning today, Monday, as that country's parliament prepares to vote on Thursday on plan to change the constitution and allow President Blaise Compaoré to stand for re-election next year. He has been in power for 27 years, but opposition parties and some civil society groups say Mr. Compaoré must respect the constitution, and they say they plan to continue their protest. Atanase Budo is a senior member of the Union for Renaissance. He says the country is tense as the opposition mobilizes for mass protest to prevent President Compaoré from changing the constitution.
Monday morning, I think that is the main thing about our demonstration. So you have everywhere young boys organize themselves to protest tomorrow morning about 5 a.m. to block the access of Ouagadou. But Tuesday is the main demonstration of the opposition.
Why do you want to protest?
We have in, the business civil, business civil is when somebody refuses to follow the constitution term, we decided to refuse to follow the constitution term. So we decided at the moment that Mr. Blaise Compaoré tried to vote the law about the modification of our constitution. So we decided to manifest Monday, Tuesday, the whole day.
The National Assembly will on Thursday study the proposed constitutional amendment. Why don't you wait until the National Assembly makes its decision?
You know, if you take the number of deputies, we have 127 deputies. But now, opposition deputy is 28 deputies. So if you decided to go to vote, not sure for us to attend our action. We lost. But if you want, we will go to the assembly. At the same time, we will go to protest. So our deputy will go in the assembly and the militants at the same time continue to protest.
Atanase Budo is a senior member of the Union for Renaissance. He was speaking with me from the Burkina Faso capital, Ouagadougou. It is Monday morning, October 27th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Daybreak Africa time is 16 and a half minutes past the hour. For the second year in a row, thousands of high school graduates have failed the University of Liberia entrance exams. Last year, all 25,000 students who took the exams failed. This year, only 15 out of 13,000 students passed the exams. Dr. Emmett Dennis, president of the University of Liberia, says the students are not dumb, but rather they are casualties of Liberia's civil war and the subsequent recovery process. He also said part of the problem is lack of enough qualified elementary and high school teachers to prepare the students. But Dr. Dennis says the university is not going to compromise on its new entrance exam policy.
The criteria used are 50% in math and 70% in English. The test is based on curriculum set by the Minister of Education. The second aspect has to do with the WIAC exam. The WIAC passing goes from rank 1 to rank 8. If you score from rank 1 to rank 8, you've passed the WIAC. If you score rank 1, you don't have to take your entrance exam. So I went to the director of WIAC. I said, I would like to eliminate people who rank 7 and 8 because we're having such a high failure rate. To reduce the frustration of the students, if you rank 7 and 8, go back and take the WIAC before coming to earlier. He said, you will eliminate 98% of the people who will take your entrance exam because 98% of the students who pass the WIAC exam rank as 7 and 8, according to the WIAC director. Our exam is based on the curriculum put forth by the Ministry of Education. And this year, we went further than last year. We actually gave the participants the old exams to study from.
Dr. Dennis, this is the second year in a row that we have had this mass failure of university entrance. So where do you think the problem lies? Is it academic or is it lack of funding?
Well, look, it is academic in a sense. There is not yet enough qualified teachers in our country for our high schools, elementary schools, and even colleges. It's a specialty of our recovery. We are at a point that we do not have sufficient highly qualified teachers in high school at this point in time. However, in the transition, I feel we can do three things. One is to return to the vacation school kind of thing that we had in the past, this time focusing on math and English, and bring in our math and English teachers from our high schools and elementary school each vacation time, and give them an immersion program in teaching math and English. Number two, try to develop another kind of immersion program between high school and college for our senior students, sort of in preparation for going to college. The third thing we can do is to do deliberate investment in the teacher colleges to ensure there's an increased production of more highly qualified elementary and high school teachers.
Dr. Emmett Dennis is the president of the University of Liberia. He was speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. Polls have closed in Tunisia's first full-term parliamentary elections since they overthrew their dictator in the 2011 revolution that kicked off the Arab Spring. Candidates from some 90 political parties competed Sunday for 217 seats in parliament. The members of the parliament will then elect a new prime minister. Lisa Bryant has more on the elections from Paris.
Sunday's vote dominated Tunisia's airwaves as voters lined up early in the morning to cast their ballots. This is the second legislative vote the country has held since its landmark revolution 3 years ago, and the first under its new constitution. Tunis resident Mariam Touati waited in line for her turn at a polling station in the old Medina area. Touati says she supports programs targeting youth. She's tired of the old politicians who don't represent people's expectations. What's key, she says, are realistic political programs emphasizing education and economic development and not just idle talk. Voter Ihab Atia hopes the elections will achieve a national consensus so Tunisia can move forward to achieve prosperity. Dozens of parties and hundreds of candidates are running for a place in the 217-seat parliament. With radical groups threatening to disrupt the vote, security was reinforced in many places. Hundreds of national and international monitors were at hand to ensure a free and fair vote. The moderate Islamist El Nahda party is considered a front runner, although it's expected to score less strongly than 3 years ago when it won the last legislative elections. Its main opponent is expected to be Nida Tunis, a new secular alliance that includes members of the former regime. Tunisia is considered the birthplace of the so-called Arab Spring and still a rare success story in a region where other uprisings have exploded into violence. But Tunisia analyst Anthony Dworkin of the European Council on Foreign Relations says the North African country remains more of a symbol than a model for the Arab world.
I think it would be an illusion to think that the Tunisian example is going to quickly bring other countries in the region along with it. I think Tunisia, at this point, it looks like an exception for all sorts of reasons.
Still, Tunisia's democracy remains fragile and its economy is struggling. Jobs, economic growth, and security are top priorities for many voters. Election results are expected to be announced on Wednesday. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Divisions have emerged between top U.S. health officials and two state governors who imposed rigorous quarantine protocols for American medical professionals returning from Ebola-stricken African nations. As VOA's Michael Bowman reports, New York and neighboring New Jersey took steps on their own after New York registered its first Ebola case, that of a Doctors Without Borders physician who had worked in the West African nation of Guinea.
Fears of possible Ebola contagion in one of America's largest and most densely populated cities, New York, led Governor Andrew Cuomo and New Jersey Governor Chris Christie to strengthen quarantine measures in their states.
This is too serious to be dealing with voluntary quarantine. I mean, it makes no sense to me. We are significantly increasing the screening process for people who want to come into the New York, New Jersey area.
We have the legal authority to do it. We're doing it.
Triggering concerns, Doctors Without Borders physician Craig Spencer, who is being treated for Ebola in the New York hospital while his fiancée remains under house quarantine. Meanwhile, complaints from a nurse who returned from Sierra Leone and is now under mandatory isolation in New Jersey. Casey Hickox ran a fever but has tested negative for Ebola. She wrote a U.S. newspaper that, quote, the U.S. must treat returning healthcare workers with dignity and humanity.
One, we need to protect the American public. But two, we need to make the decisions based on scientific data.
U.S. infectious disease specialist Anthony Fauci is critical of quarantine protocols in New York and New Jersey.
The scientific data tells us that people who are without symptoms, with whom you don't come into contact with body fluids, are not a threat. As a scientist and as a health person, if I were asked, I would not have recommended that.
Last week, President Barack Obama hugged cured Ebola patient Nina Pham.
We have to work together at every level, federal, state, and local. And we have to keep leading the global response, because the best way to stop this disease, the best way to keep Americans safe, is to stop it at its source in West Africa.
But New Jersey Governor Christie is defending his decision to boost quarantine protocols.
My first and foremost obligation is to protect the public health and safety of the people of New Jersey.
Stop Ebola!
No!
As U.S. fears over Ebola continue, African immigrants march to the United Nations, decrying stigmatization they perceive from society at large. Michael Bowman, VOA News, Washington.
The captain and the goalkeeper of South Africa's national soccer team has been shot dead at a home near Johannesburg. 27-year-old Senzo Miyiwa was gunned down after two men entered the house where he was staying. Another accomplice waited outside. All three fled after Miyiwa was shot. Other people in the house at the time were unharmed. Local media said it was an attempted burglary, but this was not confirmed by police. It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Mark Owuma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we begin with football. First half goals scored by Desiree Oparanozie and Asisato Shoala propelled the Nigeria Super Falcons to a 2-0 triumph over Cameroon's indomitable Lionesses in the finals at the Telecom Namibia Mobile Africa Women's Championships at the Sam Nujoma Stadium in Katutura Township of Windhoek, Namibia on Saturday. The Super Falcons have now won this trophy on a record 7 outings. Earlier on, Rebecca Ida scored a goal 6 minutes to the end of play to lift Ivory Coast's Lady Elephants to victory against South Africa's Banyana Banyana by a solitary goal in the bronze medal playoff. Consequently, Ivory Coast joined Nigeria and Cameroon in presenting Africa's challenge for glory at the 2015 FIFA Women's World Cup in Canada. Still in Windhoek, with 5 goals to her credit, Nigeria's Super Falcon striker Desiree Oparanozie clinched the Scorpion Zinc Award for the tournament's top scorer. Her teammate Asisato Shoala received the Telecom Namibia Best Player Award for the competition's most valuable player. Cameroon's goalkeeper Annette Ngondom took the Air Namibia Best Goalkeeper Award, while South Africa's Banyana Banyana claimed the Confederation of African Football Fair Play Award. Cameroon will host the next Africa Women's Championships. Elsewhere, Algeria's Intensative held their Democratic Republic of Congo hosts AS Vita to a 2-2 draw in the opening round of the Orange Africa Champions League final in Kinshasa on Sunday. On a sad note, South Africa's 2009 World Athletics Championship 800-meter gold medalist and 2004 Olympic silver medalist Mbulaini Mulautsi passed away in a car accident in Johannesburg, South Africa on Saturday. While in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, Kenya women's cricket captain Emily Chepngetich Ruto died after a short illness. On a more cheerful note, Uganda beat the United States of America by 24 runs to maintain their unbeaten run at the Pepsi ICC World Cricket League Division 3 in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia on Sunday. Earlier on Friday, they pipped Singapore by 1 run in their second match after beating Nepal by 20 runs in their opener. Today, Monday, Uganda tackle hosts Malaysia. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark, and have a very good day. That's it for this Monday, October 27 edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as post editor Mark Oman, along with all of our engineers, including Carl Sterling, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that all of you in Africa will have a very productive week.
Sports fans, this is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.
VOA News is always at the tip of your fingers.
All the news you want about Africa and the world, day and night, is available on voaafrica.com.
voaafrica.com.
Make it your first source of news and information.